From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened at the 45-day legislative session this year, which ended last night with a record $19 billion budget and a record number of bills passed, 573. Lawmakers had some big ambitions for revising the state's tax system. That didn't happen. They argued over guns and weak beer and daylight saving, the state flag, Gila monsters. There's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the 2019 legislative session, which ended last night. Julia Ritchie, Nicole Nixon from KUER are here. Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune also here. We're talking about what happened and what might happen in the task force and what didn't happen. Let's talk about hate crimes. This is a big deal. How long have they been at this?
I think 5 years at least, yeah. Since 2016, I think. I think that was one of my first legislative sessions, so I've seen this come up and get a little bit and then die and then come up for 2 more years and not go anywhere. So I think we've talked about this a little bit on our podcast about how headlines maybe have played a big part in pushing this forward. Also, mm-hmm. The fact that the LDS Church came out and said, we're not going to oppose this, yeah. And we never really have. But there was the case with the Lopez family in Salt Lake City where the man came in and said, I'm looking to kill a Mexican and beat them. They
and
were charged.
Sengil could not bring a charge.
Yeah, and they had to be charged federally with hate crimes. And Sengil and other prosecutors have been arguing for a long time that the state hate crimes law has no teeth, and it's, I don't think, ever been enforced right under this current state law. So this has been a long time coming, a long time in the works, really big victory. Governor Herbert says he's going to sign this one.
And I think just briefly on the LDS Church position or stating a position on it, I think more than anything, there was a perception that the church opposed it, whether they did or not. And until they came out and clarified their position of neutrality, then it was shutting down the discussion. Once they said, we're neutral on it, then all those conversations started happening. And in the end, the bill passed with well over 2/3 support. I think it got 64 votes in the House, a bill that couldn't get a hearing in the Senate just last year. And so I think you saw the change, both, as Nicole mentioned, driven by the events that transpired in the last year, and also I think by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints position on it.
Not to take away from the significance of a hate crimes bill passing, especially in light of, the shooting in New Zealand today and against a mosque and those headline grabbing hate crimes that are actually occurring.
Yeah.
But in order to gain those big majorities that passed this bill, they added a lot to the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't just limited to race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation, which were always going to be on the list. They added
age, matriculation, and
so
status
BYU
as a first responder.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, the House added political expression, which a lot of Democrats thought, they're just trying to protect Trump supporters now, right? There's this perception among conservatives, the Ben Shapiro crowd, that that campuses are cracking down on political expression and conservative thinking. And so I don't think that speaks very well of some in the legislature that may not have voted for this if they hadn't felt that their own class was protected, right? Because it's one thing to go out on a limb and say, yeah, we need to protect our minority and our vulnerable communities. But it's another thing to say, yeah, and I feel vulnerable too, and I feel threatened. And we actually heard some speeches like that on the House floor, which, make of that what you will. But this is still a significant piece of legislation, even with all of the caveats that they had to add to it.
Gun bills. But what happened there? This seemed like a mixed bag, I guess, from wherever you
Yeah.
There was a lot of small movement, I think, on sort of cracking down on domestic violence and access to guns.
Two red flag, so-called red flag bills.
Two competing red flags. So one is the red flag bill where law enforcement could get a warrant to take someone's weapons that they think might be a threat to themselves or the public. That never got a hearing. And the one that passed is sort of a watered down version that says if you think someone in your household is a threat, then and you have an ownership share in those firearms, then you can take those firearms and give them to law enforcement for a short period of time. That's the one that made it through. There was also one. Both of these come from Representative Corey Malloy, who's sort of now the pro-gun bill runner on the Hill. His other one was to double down on the state's Stand Your Ground law and just clarify that if you feel threatened by somebody, there is no duty to retreat, and basically you'll be safe if you harm someone in self-defense.
Yeah, I think it was more significant what didn't make it mm-hmm. through. Just again, background checks, open carry restrictions around schools, those things just
criminalizing safe storage. There was another safe storage law to incentivize safe storage. So they had that carrot for safe storage, but they didn't do the stick for safe storage.
And the legislature sent a big signal when the first gun bill they even considered was a resolution saying we don't need any more gun laws. And that was really controversial. And eventually it petered out after some pushback. But again, that sends a message that we don't really want to touch gun laws too much.
And help me out with this, but I think there were a couple gun bills that were sponsored in the aftermath of the Laura McCluskey shooting up here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think both of those failed, one of them making somebody civilly liable for loaning a gun to somebody. And the other one, I believe, was a background check bill, if I remember right. I would say not even really a mixed bag on gun bills this year. I think they, you know, took a couple steps backward. They had a couple opportunities. The red flag bill that Nicole mentioned was the top priority of the suicide task force, the Safe Schools Task Force mm-hmm. that came out, and it couldn't even get a hearing because it was being held in rules by leadership.
Can I ask then more broadly? You mentioned sort of the message that some of these things are intended to send. We often get a lot of message bills mm-hmm. that are related to ideology, and the reigning ideology right now is conservatism. Were there a lot of message bills? Were lawmakers sending bills? Was there a lot of really sort of deeply conservative rhetoric?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was the 30,000-foot view of this session. I thought this was one of the meaner, nastier, kind of more tension-filled sessions I've felt, and I think a lot of that came from a lot of these message bills. I think, you know, these abortion bills that passed, the one that 18 weeks and the one that's that prohibits abortion solely for the reason that the fetus has Down syndrome, they're kind of pointless bills because they don't even trigger until the courts have ruled on them. So they're just a message bill at that point. And there were quite a few of those. And I think the way that they approached the conversion therapy bill became a message bill. I think Merrill Nelson's bill that didn't get a hearing, but he proposed it that would prohibit a transgender individual from changing their gender on their birth certificate didn't serve a purpose. He couldn't articulate a problem in the last 40 years that we've been allowing this in the state. But he made that a bill that kind of caused. I mean, it was just petty and nasty. And so I think there was a lot more of that this session than I've seen in the past. And I think maybe it's because, as Julie said at the beginning, that it's a lot of new people coming in that want to kind of put their conservative mark on it. But it had a different feel to it than I think I've seen in at least the last 12 years I've been up there.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's because we're kind of heading into the 2020 election as well. There's going to be a new governor in 2020 and President Trump's going to be running for re-election. But yeah, I thought there was like this Fox News filter that was placed over the whole legislative process this year where we were hearing a lot about socialism. And I did a story on that and how every time there was a bill that was against something, you know, a Democratic bill, mm-hmm. it was socialism. And we just saw that over and over again with this a lot of Fox News talking points making their way into floor debates, even on things like the abortion bills and referencing the abortion expansion laws in New York and Virginia. And it felt like a lot of things that were happening nationally were having an effect on things that were being introduced locally here in our legislature.
And it's not that that doesn't happen, but it was just felt more prevalent, mm-hmm. I think, than I've seen in recent years.
Takeaways. What are your as you were reflecting back on what happened and what might not have happened and how it happened, Julia, you want to start?
Yeah, I just think it's a rocky marriage right now between the House and the Senate, and they're going to have to work a little bit more closely to figure out their messaging, especially on things like tax reform that affects so many people. But I wanted to highlight what I thought was significant were these small changes to the criminal justice. Again, this is an issue where the legislature has moved to the left a little bit over the years. And so we saw a lot of small little changes, but they're going to impact people in a really big way. So automatic expungement for misdemeanors, so you have clean slate. And then even smaller things, and I know this is like not important, but it is important if you're just an everyday Utahn. You won't have to like upgrade your driver's license
for eight years. Yeah.
Like that's honestly like no one's going to like, woo, they did that. But that's awesome, right? Because no one likes going to the DMV. Or like you won't have to have a front license plate anymore put on your car. Just little tiny things like that. They don't get a lot of attention for good reason, but I think they make a big difference in your everyday life as a Utahn.
We haven't talked a lot about symbols, but the state flag has gotten so much attention.
So much attention.
And that commission to review the state flag did not get through, so the state flag will stay the same. Also, I sat through this hearing where these seventh graders from Southern Utah came up and asked the legislature to make the Gila monster the state reptile, which is a symbol we don't have. And that was the final bill that passed this session, so yay for the Gila monster.
Did someone bring one up?
No, but I learned a lot about the Gila monster. I think lawmakers did too, that their venom has never killed a person and can actually help with diabetes treatment. Kind of interesting.
We hardly even have Gila monsters, but I guess, you know. Whatever.
They are in a tiny
little
part
southwest
of the state.
Corner of the state.
Robert, we're out of time. Final thoughts.
You know, I think it's an incomplete session. I think it's not, they didn't do taxes. They didn't do tax cuts. They didn't really do a budget fully. They, as Nicole mentioned, they didn't do the flag. They didn't, you know, and so I think maybe it's because this is a new group and that hadn't done their homework. They didn't come in prepared. But, you know, and it's kind of a thing that we're moving to this continuous legislative session. They like to pride themselves on 45 days. And I'm sorry, I know that's the title of your podcast. But we're going beyond 45 days now. We've had special sessions every year. We're going to have more special sessions this year. And really, the work is going to be going on continuously throughout the year. I think the session's incomplete. And I think it's hard to give them a grade on when they didn't complete their work.
Beyond 45 days, that's a snappy name for a podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to talk about this gay conversion therapy bill. I think it seemed really dramatic how this particular bill played out, and then it was sort of hijacked by another lawmaker. Julie, you want to give us a sense of how this, or Nicole, how this played out? There was a lot of drama in this story.
Yeah, well, when we knew this was happening, there was a lot of excitement about it. And then it got sort of this grand unveiling in a press conference a few weeks into the session with two Republican co-sponsors. Mm-hmm. And I think that sent a strong signal that it had a really good chance.
And the LDS Church remaining neutral, mm-hmm. not speaking out against
right.
it.
Yeah. And a lot of work from Equality Utah on this support, you know, pretty broad support, I think. And it got its first hearing, and you had people who had undergone it come and talk about how harmful it had been for them. Then you had this substitute by the House Judiciary Chairwoman, Carrie Ann Lisenby, after 2 days of very emotional hearing on both sides of this issue. And she's proposed this substitute that basically gutted the bill and keeps conversion therapy in law. She was arguing to scale it back a bit. They kept this gender identity piece in there. They passed the substitute. It became clear, I think, in that committee that the original bill didn't have the support to get out of that committee. You had also Governor Herbert supporting the original bill and then coming out and supporting the substitute, which the sponsor, Craig Hall, said was a hostile substitute and he didn't support it. So after that was adopted, he said, this isn't good enough for me. I can't support this. And he shelved the bill for now. I think this is one of those issues that, you know, it's going to come back. We can talk about the drama. There was a lot of drama after this whole thing happened. But the governor says he supports coming back to it next year. Craig Hall says he supports coming back to it next year. And Equality Utah wants to come back to it next year.
How unique was it that there was a group of students who staged a sit-in, sort of, and and Spencer Cox, lieutenant governor, goes out and presents a letter. This seemed like kind of dramatic, apologizing. What did you make of that? I couldn't tell if was this sort of politically motivated? Was this sincere? Was this a kind of a lovely moment, or was this manipulation? What did you all make of that?
I think the governor's office recognized there was a significant misstep. I mean, that's what Governor Herbert kept referring to it as, a miscommunication, a misunderstanding, that by supporting Representative Lisenby's substitute, that they hadn't fully thought through the implications or whether it even had support from the other side of the aisle, right? Mm-hmm. This wasn't a compromise bill at all. So I think there was a genuine apology there. I think that the activists, though, to me, it reminded me of after the Parkland, Florida shooting. We've just seen students become so much more active. We have, high school students across the country suing over climate change now. So you're just seeing a lot more young people paying attention to these issues. Mm-hmm.
Going up there.
Yeah. And it's such a positive sign, in my opinion, that there is this conversation happening between lawmakers who are making policy for these people who are the rising generation. They're actually interacting with these younger folks on the Hill. So, I think that exchange got so much attention because it was significant. Yeah.
And what's really impressive to me is that these students are not only showing up, but they seem to really grasp the process. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are March for Our Lives students in almost every hearing about a gun bill. And we were getting intel from some of them that a certain bill was dead in rules. And yeah. it was so impressive to me.
What did you make of all that process?
You know, I was surprised, I guess, that the governor got turned the way he did. I think one of the most shocking things about the way that process played out was the second day of hearing, where he had all of the conversion therapists that showed up. Because I was kind of under the impression that this was not something that was widely practiced, but these people turned out in numbers, and it's not a relic of the 1970s. There was some drama, a dramatic moment where one of the people who was testifying about the damage conversion therapy does, later in the hearing, his conversion therapist was testifying in support of the bill, and yeah. And he had to sit there and listen to this person talking about how it can work, and right after he had talked about how it drove him to the brink of suicide, and so. It's an emotionally fraught issue. I think I think the governor's office getting flipped the way it did was unexpected. I think some of it got more emotional, I think, after these Facebook posts that Carrie Ann Lisenby had made several years ago, defending the practice of conversion therapy, saying it can work, saying that young people kill themselves because they're gay, because they live a homosexual lifestyle, and that electroshock therapy isn't torture and conversion therapy can save them. That sort of thing sort of illustrated, I think, the motivations of her substitute more than what she was saying about wanting to try to find some middle ground. And so I was hopeful, I guess, or at least expected that they might take a shot at trying to get it through this session, but I think they're going to, work on it over the interim and come back next year. But it's going to be emotional next year too, and I think it's and one of the important things that some people are missing in this is that this only applies to youth, people under the age of 18. We're not talking about adults who want to try conversion therapy can do whatever they want, but to impose this practice on young people when the studies when it's been repudiated by the LDS Church, by every legitimate scientific organization in the country, and has been shown in scientific studies to double to triple the rate of suicide, I think is something that we need to take very seriously.
For me, it shows this division within the Republican Party, even though Utah has moved way to the left on LGBTQ issues, that there is still some gradation within the Republican Party. So, as Nicole said, there were two Republican sponsors of the original bill, we should say. Yeah. They were more on the, I don't know, one was definitely more on the moderate side of the Republican aisle. whereas Representative Karen Lisenby is way, way, way to the right. She's way down there. Yeah. She's running the, you know, she ran an anti-abortion bill this year. She's not exactly known as an LGBT champion on the Hill. So within the Republican Party itself, there's some wiggle room as far as like how far they will go on these, I would call them, social issues.
Let me ask about education, public and higher. So if I have these numbers right, $280 million in new ongoing money for public education, $236 million about for higher education. Put that in perspective for us. Was this a good year for – I mean, it seems like advocates are saying, yeah, this was a decent year for us.
It could have been worse for sure. The lawmakers were declaring victory. You know, I think they've put – it was about
don't they always do that, though?
Yeah, it was about a 4% increase in per-student spending. I think that's been the norm for the last few years. Governor Herbert has – you know, he wants to be the education governor like almost every governor. So he has delivered, though.
Yeah. I think they're pleased with it. They fended off some potential income tax cuts because the tax bill died, and so that would have taken money out of education. Higher ed was, I think a lot of their money was in buildings. I think they so that counts toward that. But yeah, I mean, it's chipping away at this hole we're in. We're still last in the country, and competing, we're nipping at Idaho's heels, but you know, it's going to take a couple more years of good increases to get there.
Let's talk about air quality. The governor had proposed spending a lot. It was $100 million he had proposed. That didn't happen. But then you're also hearing from advocates that are saying, well, we didn't expect $100 million anyway, and what we got was, I think, what was $28 million mm-hmm. dollars in one-time money, and they're scoring that as a kind of a cautious win.
I think right? so. That this is the most, I believe.
I think in past years they were happy to get $2 million.
Yeah.
So this is a significant increase for air quality efforts. And Representative Patrice Arendt, who co-chairs the Clean Air Caucus, was saying, you know, this is going to go a long way. They did things like they funded, I think one of the biggest appropriations was for swapping out wood stoves for cleaner burning appliances, another one to create more free fare days on bad air days and during inversion spells so that we can just hop on tracks or a bus as opposed to getting in our cars. So it seems like they put a lot of thought into all of these different bills, and then it added up. It actually added up in the end.
So I want to talk about so there's this kind of irony here. So there's this bill to ban handheld cell phones while driving that came up. Didn't pass. There was resistance from some conservatives who had this kind of libertarian bent that this was an infringement on, you know, personal liberty. But then so they don't go along with that, right? So how is it that lawmakers can pass one of the most restrictive DUI laws in the country under the premise of public safety and then vote against this bill? Is there an irony there?
No, you push all my buttons there. No, it's fascinating because if you look at the statistics, significantly more people die from distracted driving because of a cell phone than they do from the 0.05 DUI. And so they talk about how important it is to save lives, but they don't want to do this thing that infringes on their personal freedom. You know, I think infringing on others' freedom is one thing, but infringing on their own personal freedom is something entirely different. This bill has come up again and again and again, and it keeps getting defeated. And part of the logic is, well, you know, you're not actually going to change the behavior by making it illegal. If people should already know that this is dangerous and they shouldn't be doing it. But I don't know. When I've gone to California where I know it's illegal, I'm a lot more conscientious about making sure I just put the phone away while I'm driving. And it makes – I think it makes a difference. But, you know, it's an uphill battle. I think it's probably getting a little bit more traction than it has in the past because I think people are seeing how ubiquitous cell phone use is and how dangerous it is and how many accidents it does cause. And I think also cars are getting smarter, so you don't need to use, you know, a lot more hands-free ability now than there used to be. So I think eventually we might get there, but it's an uphill fight.
Wasn't there an argument about 10 years ago with seatbelts and changing behavior
exactly.
that you can't legislate behavior change? But I don't know. Maybe I'm asking you, did that actually help
I think right now I look at my kids right now and they always buckle up, and I know when I was a kid I was bouncing around the back seat, so you know, somehow I survived. But it's, yeah, I think it has changed behavior.
The worst part of that debate though is it came about 20 minutes after lawmakers passed this bill to allow cars to run red lights if they pause for like 90 seconds. Yeah. Yeah. It didn't actually, that bill didn't get through all the way, but still it sends this message of like, do we want Utah drivers to be known as the worst in the country? Apparently we do. So,
all right. It's a decent segue, I suppose, into beer.
Yes.
So there's this extraordinary story that Nicole, you and Julia were talking about this remarkable presentation, PowerPoint presentation that plays out. So lay this story out for us, because I think this is kind of...
Julia was there. It was called Fear the Beer.
Fear the Beer, yeah.
Right. So Senator Jerry Stevenson is like the alcohol point person on the Hill. He'd been working on this issue for a while, which is that a lot of bigger brewers are no longer brewing 3.2 beer because so many states are not have already raised the cap on their limit. So he came out with this bill. It kind of sailed through the Senate. Not a lot of debate, right, Nicole?
People trust him on alcohol issues, I think. And this has been an issue for a few years, and he's sort of declined to run it for a couple of years to give people some time to get used to it.
And he's not a drinker, right? He is LDS. Yep. But when it got to the House, it was just languishing in rules for a while. And we came to find out that the new rules chair, Representative Tim Hawks, was very much against it, had a lot of concerns about it. And so he sent it to the Health and Human Services Committee as opposed to a Business and Labor Committee.
Now, explain the significance of that.
Well, this is a commerce bill, right? It's about consumer choice, in Stevenson's words. You know, so consumers have adequate choices when they go to the grocery store. But to Hawks, in his opinion, it was it's a health and safety issue because he does not think that we should raise the cap on beer. So... the beer lobby had been asking to make a presentation to the Republican caucus, to the GOP caucus, all session, and they never did. And then one day, this is like the last week of the session, he has a PowerPoint presentation that he plays for the caucus. The beer lobby is sitting in the back of the room.
Wow.
And it says, Fear the Beer. And he has put pictures of car crashes and a pickled liver. And just these scary images from the internet.
Now, this guy doesn't drink either, right?
No, of course not. No. And said, the reason I sent it to Health and Human Services is because I do believe we should consider the unintended consequences of raising the cap. And he went on to argue that basically if we raise the cap on alcohol, that people will drink as much beer as they do now, and they'll get drunker, and they'll crash their cars, and it'll lead to more fetal alcoholism. It was just a lot of scare tactics. I mean, Robert, you were in the room too.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of the sky is falling kind of thing. One of them that really shocked me was like, so if you go from 3.2 to 4.8, you have 50% more people are going to be consuming 50% more alcohol. Mm-hmm. Well, that presumes that everybody drinks the same volume of beer, right? And so, you know, and they talked about young people, you know, they want to drink beer and drink as much beer as they can. Well, physiologically, they can only drink so much beer. And whether it's 3.2 or 4.8, there's still, you know, there are limits on what they're going to be able to do. But, the fetal alcohol syndrome one was one that kind of boggled my mind, too, because I could be wrong. I'm not a doctor, but I think that more people get fetal alcohol syndrome is probably more common from people who buy their alcohol at the state-run liquor store than from 3.2 beer. And so the state doesn't have a problem with the state-run liquor stores, but, you know, the 3.2 to 4.8 is going to bring about the end of times. And so, it was this big showdown, though, because whereas, you know, Hawks is the rules chair. He's got control over that bill. He's also their point man on alcohol, and people are looking to him for some guidance on how to do that, on how to navigate this. He made an argument that if you go into your store, you can still see beer. So everything's fine. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of where we ended up. There was also just real quick, there was this interesting dynamic with the local breweries, too, where there was a little bit of a divide where some of the local breweries, the Utah Brewers Guild, I think is what it is, supported or opposed going to 4.8, which you would might think that, well, they want more latitude to brew the beer that they want to brew.
Yeah.
But, you know, their point is that, you know, let's not change the law for Budweiser and Coors and these big out-of-state breweries, you know, and you know, also, I think it probably didn't hurt that if those other breweries were pushed out by the limit, that creates more opportunity for them to move in and take that space. So anyway, they ended up a compromise where they are going to raise it to 4.0, revisit it down the road once they get some data. 4.0 takes in most of these big breweries. That's what the Coors and Anheuser-Busch's wanted, and then they're going to, you know, study the issue for the next year
on a task force.
It is the task force.
No, it's the work group. Now.
Hawks had to get in one last dig though last night when he brought up the bill. He said motion to consider better life choices, which wow. Yeah, I know. So that just speaks to that again, that divide between teetotalers who dominate our legislature and maybe the drinking public in Salt Lake City and beyond.
It's Julia Ritchie, reporter here at KUER. She and Nicole Nixon of KUER as well produced the 45 Days podcast about the Utah legislative session. Go check it out. When does the new one drop?
This afternoon.
Okay, so check that out. Robert Gerke, also with us of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah lawmakers ended their 2019 legislative session last night at like 11 o'clock, which is weird. They hardly ever end a session early. And there are times when they're really frantic, they're speed reading bills and covering up the clock, like literally covering up the clock, but not this year, which is not to say they didn't have unfinished business. They did, but a lot of this is going to be dealt with later in these interim sessions and on these task forces. And they did pass a lot of bills, 573. They passed a big budget, $19 billion. What they didn't do was reform the state's tax system or redesign the state flag or ban gay conversion therapy. They did cut back on a citizens initiative to expand Medicaid. They spent money, maybe not enough, but a lot on clean air and on public and higher education. They passed two abortion bills, finally passed a hate crimes bill, and they argued over guns and weak beer and daylight saving and Gila monsters. And so today in the program, we're going to be talking about what happened and what didn't at the legislative session. Julia Ritchie and Nicole Nixon are with us, reporters, of course, at KUER, host the podcast 45 Days about the legislative session. They've been covering the session, of course. And welcome back, you two.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke is also back with us. He's a columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome to you.
Thanks. We made it through another one.
Yes, apparently you did. And yeah. I'll invite listeners to join us if they like, if they have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Okay, let's begin broadly, I guess. So start out the session. You've got new leadership. And you've got this kind of ambitious idea of reforming, and we'll talk about why, but the state tax code, because the economy's changing, all those kinds of things. So did it seem like an ambitious kind of start?
Yes, definitely an ambitious start, because not only was the leadership new, but we should mention that nearly a quarter of the legislature was new, too. So a lot of these lawmakers were new to the legislative process. They had just rolled off of a special session, we should mention, last year to revise Proposition 2 for medical marijuana. So there was some, I would say some bad blood sort of still simmering from that fight. And then, of course, making tax reform their number one priority. What did they do at the beginning of the session? They messed with another ballot initiative.
Yeah.
Completely, I guess, throwing off the whole narrative that Governor Herbert and Republican leaders had wanted to kind of carry the day.
How do you explain that, by the way? That is interesting. I thought that they were – it was weird how they waited until – not the last minute, but I don't know. It was the last 2 or 3 weeks when they started the whole – to actually debate the whole tax reform thing. Why they started with the Medicaid thing, what do you guys make of that?
Well, they wanted to get Medicaid done right out of the gate. Yeah. They wanted it cleared off the plate, you know, and they wanted to start the process of getting these waivers they're going to have to get from the Department of Health. And so they just wanted that checked off and they could get to it right away without we're having to worry about when the revenue numbers come in and that sort of thing. So and I think Julia is right. I think that medical marijuana special session kind of set the tone for this, even though it was, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of new people. There were a lot of holdovers. And so it sort of set the tone, teed up this Medicaid revision, I guess, replacement that they came up with. And that Medicaid replacement kind of got the session moving in sort of a weird kind of clunky way, I think, and set the tone for the 45 days that were to come.
What did you make of all of that?
Well, I think the Medicaid took a lot of the oxygen out right out of the gate. We know that they've been thinking about and sort of working on tax reform for a few years now. I do think it was strange that we didn't see a bill for 5 weeks and we were asking about it every week. Are we going to see tax reform this week? And maybe. And then we finally saw the bill with only 2 weeks left. And I think that had a lot to do with it fizzling out, the fact that it got a hearing in the House and people really turned up to speak against it. Mm-hmm. And the Senate, I know, really wanted to have their own hearing. But when the clock started to run out on it, I think that's when they realized it just didn't have the time to happen.
The thing about the tax reform debate is it was completely – they were completely unprepared to have it, mm-hmm. I think, is – when they did income tax reform back in 2008, 2009, it started actually under Governor Olene Walker. Yeah. And she started this task force that had town hall meetings and studied this issue for years with experts coming in and providing data and charts and things like that. And the income tax, by comparison to the sales tax, is a very simple tax to change, right? You get your income, you pay tax on it. Yeah. It's that simple. Sales tax is a lot more nuanced. And I just don't think they were at all prepared for what they were getting into when they started looking at, okay, we're going to tax attorneys, but if it's an attorney that works in-house, they're not going to be taxed. If it's an attorney that works, you know, there were so many subtleties and nuances to it that they just weren't prepared for it. And I think they got overwhelmed by it, especially when they rolled out their first proposal and all of these groups came out and said, wait,
what are you doing?
This is not going to work for us. And so I think they did the right thing in punting on it. I think we'll have to see how the next few months it shape up. And if we get a special session, I think they're talking about June or July is when they want to do it or when the House wants to do it. I think the Senate maybe is a little bit more nonchalant and laissez-faire about it. So we'll see how that shakes out.
Julia, explain just a little bit about why they need to reform the system as it is. I mean, you've talked about this on your podcast, that there's this economic transition that's been playing out for decades now. It used to be all about goods. Now it's more about services, and they need to fix it because they're not getting enough sales tax revenue.
Right. So the condensed version is that our general fund is not keeping pace with our education fund. Basically, our general fund funds everything from infrastructure to public safety officials, things like that. And it's funded by the sales tax. Our sales tax base has been declining over the years because most of our sales tax are paid in things like malls, and malls are dying. And people don't go to the mall to buy things anymore.
Whatever a mall is.
What is a mall?
Yeah.
They're actually like outdoor now, too. Governor Herbert and the Republican leadership proposed putting a host of new taxes on services, because that's what people are doing now. They're streaming music. They're streaming movies. They're getting haircuts still, maybe at the mall. But those things aren't taxed right now. So the idea was, if we tax more things, then we can lower the overall rate. And that's a win-win, in his words and in the governor's words.
I was asking Nicole and Julia earlier, Robert, about whether or not there were more lobbyists on the Hill or how – I mean, because now you have all of a sudden law firms and hairstylists and health insurance, all these other people who are resisting this idea of now being charged tax.
I mean, a lot of those organizations already had pretty powerful lobbyists on the Hill anyway, but yes, they've definitely been called into action. There were other lobbyists who were brought on. The joke, obviously, in the hallways is that this is the Lobbyist Full Employment Act. And by the way, one of the things they would tax is lobbying. So maybe it was sort of a back end way to get into. But
that's a service,
you know. And I think Julia is right. It goes to this fundamental structural problem where the sales tax, just the bucket that they have to pay for all the roads, everything else just hasn't kept up with the needs, the demands of a growing state, and so they need to do something. It's just a question of what and how what their stomach is to take this fight on.
Nicole, you've talked about how this was you see it sort of as a significant loss for the governor and this new leadership in the House and Senate.
Yeah, we had a new Senate president, a new House Speaker, new majority leadership in both chambers, and the governor's in his last couple years here. He says he's not going to run again, and they had a really big chance to make a big statement out of the gate, and it was their top priority. We were told this is going to happen. This is going to happen. I think it did signal a pretty big. Maybe not a final defeat. Obviously, they're gonna punt it, but I think it does say a lot that they weren't able to wrangle their people. I know they tried to wrangle their people to get this through, but it just didn't happen.
Well, and the tax reform failing is one thing, but they also had been jockeying over who was going to give a bigger tax cut, and that didn't happen either. The governor came out in a state of the state and said, "I want $200 million in tax cuts." The speaker came out and said, "I want $225 million in tax cuts," and they really didn't. They had to put that off because they don't know what the tax system is going to look like for quite a while.
So what did we end up in the way of a tax cut? $75 million, I think it was.
Nothing yet.
No, okay.
Nothing yet.
Yeah, I think.
Sorry, no tax cut.
They're going to hold back until they can get the structure of the tax system worked out, and then kind of lower it down from there, I guess.
When there was this sort of temporary funding maneuver that went to sort of spur them to act eventually. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. So it's in order to get lawmakers back this session to actually want to even touch this issue. They made a lot of their bills one-time money, which means that they are only going to fund their pet projects for one fiscal year, as opposed to making it an ongoing appropriation. And they hope that creates some amount of leverage. I'm uncertain if that will actually work, though.
You know, it's kind of interesting, though, because as much as we complain about how Washington does things, it's almost a Washington tactic, right? We're going to pass a continuing resolution that's going to fund government up until this period of time, and in that period of time, if we don't have a budget, all of it goes away. And so that's what we saw with the government shutdown at the federal level. And I think this was what they came to, because the House was pretty upset that the Senate didn't go along with their tax reform proposal. The House sort of let out on that issue. They took all the heat. They expended all the political capital. They had the votes, they believe, but then at the end, the Senate came back and said, we don't have the votes to pass this. And so the whole thing went up in smoke. The House was really upset about that. And so that really complicated the budget issue and led to a point where the House was just going to say, we're going to pass the skinny budget, which is just this bare bones, only the things we need. The Senate wanted a full budget, and they ended up where, as Julia said, where they kind of doing this patch, this short-term patch on the budget for the next year.
In a word, a lawmaker told me that they got cocky. And so I think that's pretty fair. There was some cockiness at the beginning, as Robert just said, about trying to one-up each other on a tax cut. And then it totally kind of football, like Charlie Brown style, falling on their face about it. Yeah, I mean, I think it showed a little bit of assuredness that maybe wasn't merited.
One of the things you've talked about, Julia and Nicole, I know, is that it seems like there is, I'm not sure there's probably always the case, but the relationship between the Republicans in the House and the relationship between the Republicans in the Senate, was there more tension between those two bodies this
For
year?
Sure. It was palpable. Mm-hmm. Like it was
I think there's
rocky.
Always some sort of tension behind the scenes. Yeah. It really leaked out this year. It was very clear in sort of still subtle-ish ways, but just I was in the Senate media briefings every day, and you would ask about the House, and they would be like, "Oh, well, we don't know. It's a House bill." They did not want they didn't want to talk about the House. They didn't want to go there.
Well, and you'd think they'd be coordinating, right?
Yeah, and I think through the Medicaid thing, they actually got along pretty well. Mm-hmm. I think once the Medicaid thing was put away and they turned to tax reform, that's where things got a little choppy.
So, all right, on the Medicaid front, on that question, this is one of the things, Nicole and Julia, you mentioned that this session could be described as a fundamental clash between lawmakers and the people they represent. Let's talk a little bit about not just the Medicaid thing, because I think we've talked a bit about that, but what efforts did lawmakers then go about to really dilute and, if not entirely dismantle, but certainly weaken the initiative process? Because some lawmakers, anyway, they hate it.
Yeah, I would say if they didn't completely try to weaken the ballot initiative laws, they put in a lot of additional hurdles and red tape and things of that nature that will, in the sum of things, will make it much harder for anyone who wants to mount a ballot initiative going forward. So things like upping the number of signatures required, things like delaying the implementation of all the ballot measures until after the legislature meets so that the legislature can have their say on whatever it is that's going to go into effect. So these were all laws that passed this year. It was like a series of bills that just made little tiny tweaks, making it more standardized how you can take your name off of ballot initiative. So again, I just think that they may not never say this like outright, but they have really deep reservations about ballot initiatives. Yeah. And so the harder they can make it for citizens to pass them, the fewer there will be. And then the less conflict there will be at the legislature. Because, again, we started out the session with a huge protest over Medicaid.
Yeah.
The last few years, it feels like every session has opened with a gigantic protest of citizens up there who are upset about something they're about to do.
I will say they did not touch Proposition 4, which was the Independent Redistricting Commission. Mm-hmm. But we know they're talking about it. A lot of lawmakers, I think, seem pretty nervous about that one and have some issues with that. But they have another year, so they might do that next year.
Robert, what do you make of that? I mean, technically they can do this,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I think you get a lot of people who are outraged that they're doing this, but constitutionally, lawmakers get the final say.
Well, and I think people are right to be outraged about it because, you know, the medical marijuana issue was one that festered for years with the lawmakers not really doing much to fix it. And so they took things into their own hands. And it took time and it took money and it took commitment. And the people spoke. And this is the whole point of a democratic government, is that the people get to say, you know, what kind of policies they want. And then the lawmakers said, no, we know better. We're going to undo that. And they did the exact same thing with Medicaid expansion. This has been an issue that's been teed up for years. The governor's been pushing on it for years, tried. And the legislature said, no, no, no. And so people did it on their own. And so, and again, it took a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort. And the legislature said, well, no, you guys don't know what you're doing. Leave it to us. We can do this. And it's like, well, you had your shot, right? So the people are obviously upset about it. I will say, I think, you know, we've talked about it on the show before. I think where they ended up on the medical marijuana is not a bad place to be. Where they ended up on Medicaid is not too far from where Governor Herbert was proposing that we'd be 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So if they had just done that 5 years ago, we could have had people, we could have all this federal money coming in. We could have had all these people covered getting health care that they need, probably better outcomes, probably fewer deaths than we would have had otherwise. But this is where we've ended up now, and they're going to proceed and try to get the permission from the Trump administration to implement this.
There is an argument to be made that a ballot initiative or any law can be made better through a legislative mm-hmm. process, through hearings, public comment, things like that. But they undercut that a lot this session, again, back to this issue of cockiness, by repeatedly saying that people didn't know what they were voting for. We heard that over and over and over and over again. And that's insulting. It's insulting to people who show up, cast their ballots for these things, and then are told that they didn't know what they were voting for. I think that is what makes people upset. It makes me upset for sure.
I mean, these are pretty complicated issues though. And I think on some level they didn't know. There was even a proposal, I believe Senator Wyler was floating the idea of making all ballot initiatives in the future yes, no questions. do you want Medicaid expansion? Yes, no. And then leave the details to the legislature. And it would have been...
Because they're the clever ones, Robert.
Well, I mean, but if you look at the medical marijuana initiative, if you look at the Medicaid initiative, if you look at Prop 4, in each of those cases, the proponents even admit that there were things that needed to be fixed. And so, you know, it's hard to get right. It's hard to get right when you're drafting a bill that's you're not going to pass or it's not even going to go before voters for another 18 months. And you've got all these moving pieces, and it's tricky.
The process. They love the process.
They love the process. Just one final sort of thought on the Medicaid expansion thing. So this – so by April 1st, if they don't get the waivers, the citizen initiative idea goes into effect anyway, yes?
Well, they've got until April 1st to get the preliminary waivers to go to a 70-30 expansion. And the thinking is that those are going to be pretty simple. They've got, I believe, another year and a half to get the full expansion. No, I think it's July of 2020 to get the full expansion in place, which would be a 90-10 split. We get 90 cents on the dollar from the federal government, but we're only covering up to 100% of the poverty level. Everybody else who's above 100% would be on the Medicaid market or the insurance marketplace. And so, you know, if Utah does this, it would be the first state in the country to do it. And it would probably start a cascading effect of other states that want to, you know, revisit their deals that they've got with the federal government. And the other big thorny issue in terms of the waivers is going to be this cap that they want to put on in terms of once they run out of state money, they stop enrolling people, they go on a waiting list. That's never been done I think maybe it has. There have been states who have sought that one. So we'll see how it plays out. The governor has said he was recently back in D.C., and he said he had meetings with White House and Department of Health people, and they were getting encouraging signs in terms of the Trump administration's receptiveness to that. Critics say the reason the Trump administration is receptive to it is because he knows it will destroy Medicaid and they'll have to completely revamp the whole system.
But we should note that the bill or the law itself has a fallback mechanism which will put into effect full Medicaid expansion if all of those waivers fall through, with the caveat that they can continue to seek them indefinitely.
Okay. Julia Ritchie there and Nicole Nixon from KUER, of course, Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.